there that night. I remember the after-party upstairs at the Hammerstein. Nick Zinner was there. I think the Interpol guys were there. Longwave, Radio 4, the French Kicks, every major label talent scout, a few professional models, all the DJs, all the drug dealers, and a couple photographers who are now all big names. But it wasn't jousty. It was fun. Affirmation of a little Saturnalia after a long couple weeks of the city belching smoke and planes flying into things. There were still missing person signs everywhere. Stephen Trachtenbreit. I remember being at the soundboard during the Strokes set, feeling the entire floor just bouncing. All that energy from the Strokes, from 1,800 people, you just felt in the floor. Jim Merlis. I remember Albert sliding on his knees at the moment when the lights went up. Gideon Yeago. All the rest got away from me after that. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't on massive drugs that night, and I was certainly not alone. I'm sure I was at the library, two-way, and the slipper room. I woke up in a bed with some stranger, and my suit looked a lot cheaper in the daylight. Craig Finn. That first record is unstoppable. It was just such a moment, such a good sound, such good songs, that it was almost, what are you going to do now? I think that that's what happened, besides playing shows for a million people and dating models and all that.
Kimya Dawson. The Strokes became ambassadors, the embodiment of that leather jacket, denim, sunglasses, cool New York City in people's minds. That's New York City music. They're the new Velvet Underground.
Rob Sheffield. The idea of New York as a rock star was something people were very concerned with. Dave Gottlieb. 9/11 did affect all of this greatly. I mean, for Is This It to come out literally 2 weeks later? It made it hard for all the people that wanted to be cynical about the Strokes or take shots at them. Instead, it became about, all right, this is an underdog. 9/11 made Yeah Yeah Yeahs and the Strokes and Interpol. It made them all underdogs, because they became representative of something larger. Jesse Malin. You could feel New York was getting the love, mostly coming from overseas. But once it hit here, the kids were getting into it. It wasn't like some old thing. It wasn't some Lester Bangs thing, or some art thing. It was just young kids and hot chicks. It was decadent. You could hear these new bands in the shops when you were in the suburbs and Urban Outfitters. It was beyond the city. It was an idea. Stephen Trachtenbreit. Leaving Hammerstein with Fab that night, there was no security or fans. There was no after-party guest list or any of that, not yet. Adam Green. Afterwards, we were all in the street, and everyone was trying to figure out what to do next. Everyone felt like something had happened. It was like, we can go downtown now, and we can get out to the normal bars that we would usually go to, and hang out with each other. But the fact is that something has changed. Jim Merlis. That was the beginning of the lunacy that came next. Gideon Yeago. 6 months later, a night like that could never have happened. 6 months later, they didn't belong just to New York City anymore.
Chapter 32. Is anybody outside of New York talking about this?
Gideon Yeago.
When September 11th happened, I suddenly became an important person. They were talking about firing me at MTV the week before. There I was, this dude who was into itty-bitty indie rock bands, wearing Buddy Holly glasses. They just didn't think that I fit. Then the world changed, and suddenly I had a much more important position. They gave me my own TV show. Vito Roccaforte. The Strokes' success couldn't help but pave the way for everybody from New York. There were tons of great bands before them and after them. But in terms of that shift, there's before the Strokes and after the Strokes. All the labels were trying to sign bands, and the media attention for everybody was just crazy. Dean Wareham.
I would get on the phone and people would ask, "What do you think about Osama bin Laden? What do you think about the Strokes?" These were the two things that were going on in my town.
April Long. I remember being in Florida visiting my mom and going into Target and seeing the fake vintage t-shirts and realizing that it wasn't just a local New York City thing anymore.
Paul Banks. The first time we went to England, every person that we met said, "Do you know the Strokes?" The second question was, "Are you friends with the Strokes?" Vito Roccaforte. We did an NME photo shoot in the park in the East Village. And these young tourist girls came up to us like, "Are you guys in the Strokes?" We were like, "Yeah!" And we gave them autographs. Sam Fogarino. I got a kick out of all these European journalists thinking we're all friends. Me and Daniel, we'd do interviews together. And we would joke about, "Yeah, we have lofts together. And you know, Julian doesn't like his eggs too runny, and Nick doesn't get up until late afternoon. You can't make noise until then because he's such a little prissy." We would just go on and on and on. Vito Roccaforte. It was annoying, but it was funny. Mark Spitz. Alan Light had been editing Spin, and I was still in the frame of mind of, "All right, well, I guess I better learn to like Coldplay. Because they're better than Limp Bizkit. You know what I mean?" Alan Light. I remember feeling so skeptical. We wanted to believe so bad. Everybody started talking about the Strokes, but I was like, "Is anybody outside of New York talking about this? Or are we just so desperate that we want this to be happening?" I just had the sense that this could be interesting, but this really also could be nothing. Jim Merlis. Alan Light wasn't into it, but Sia replaced Alan, and she was the one who really championed the Strokes at Spin.
Sia Michael. I came to Spin in December 96 when it was owned by Bob Guccione Jr. and was still in the Flatiron District. I was hired as an assistant editor and my desk was in a windowless storage closet that still had brooms and mops in it on my first day. But I was psyched because I'd never had an office before. Tracy Pepper. Sia was always the smartest person in the room. She's a bit quiet, so not everyone knew how brilliant she was, unless you worked with her. Then you absolutely knew it.
Mark Spitz. Julian and I were drinking once at that bar on 13th and A, and he saw a photo of Sia. He goes, "That's Sia?" And I said, "Yeah, that's Sia Michael, the editor-in-chief." "She's beautiful." "Yeah, she's really good-looking." "She looks just like Rebecca De Mornay." And I'm like, "She also gets Tracy Lords." Jim Merlis. Of course, at Rolling Stone, the Strokes already had Jenny Eliscue in their corner. I think she'd done her first piece on them by the Halloween show. But suddenly they all came aboard like gangbusters, and it became this New York City pride thing, because all of a sudden these other bands started springing up. Austin Skaggs. We were talking about bands like Limp Bizkit and covering the swing revival and all that garbage. Boy bands. All these things that were happening in L.A. or somewhere else, and that we looked at as a joke, but regardless were forced to cover. Then all of a sudden, like right here on our fucking doorstep, right where we live, the world is changing. Mark Spitz. It was like when I first heard Adam Ant or The Clash or The Smiths. We were then looking amongst the larger Spin staff, and even some of the cooler Rolling Stone people like Jenny Eliscue and Rob Sheffield for kindred spirits. We became evangelical. It became our mission to get them more press. But it also became a competition.
Jenny Eliscue. After that first Mercury Lounge show, I just started telling everyone about the Strokes.
Rob Sheffield. It was all Jenny Eliscue. For all these New York bands, she was such a proselytizer. She was the saint of this whole environment, completely selflessly spreading the word. She was not like, "You should hear this band, but I get to write about them first." She was like, "No, you should write about them, and I should write about them, and we should all write about them."
Jenny Eliscue. But at first, nobody cared.
Austin Skaggs. Sometimes at Rolling Stone, you've got to get beaten over the head with what's going on to eventually pay attention to it.
Jenny Eliscu. The insult Joe Levy used in the early days about the band was, "Oh, you really wish you got to see the Jam, Jenny." I hadn't listened to enough of the Jam at that point to have that strong a reaction. But then I immediately went and did listen to more of the Jam, and I was like, "You know, Levy."
Joe Levy. What I meant was that there was an excitement, a moment, a movement that she missed out on. It wasn't about the music of the Jam, which I could have given a fuck about. It was about Paul Weller making statements out of the past that mattered in the present, that resonated with fans and in the press. That was some shit, but it wasn't going to happen again. Except I might as well have been talking about myself, because that was some shit I missed out on. She missed out on nothing. She was right. Rob Sheffield. Jenny's piece ran in the issue with Julia Stiles' face, and then the headline above said something like, "Tina Fey, The Strokes, Questlove. Things that are up and coming and cool." Those were all the next big things in 2001.
Jenny Eliscu. I remember at that Stroke show at Bowery, Tracy Pepper went up to Jim Merlis and asked why Rolling Stone knows about this band. I must have written a single review or something at this point. And he said, "Because they go to shows." Meaning, me. I went to shows. Tracy Pepper. Who told you that? That does sound like something I would do. If it happened, I must have been pissed. We were so competitive with Rolling Stone. A band like the Strokes belonged in Spin first, not Stone. Our readers were their audience, not Rolling Stone's baby boomer readers. I was friends with a lot of editors at Rolling Stone and liked them a lot as people, but I wanted to crush them professionally.
Mark Spitz. It's December 2001. September 11th it happened. We were all a little bit post-traumatic. It was the Spin Christmas party at the Slipper Room, which was James Haubacker and Camille Haubacker's bar on Orchard Street on the Lower East Side. I'd had a few. We had just made U2 Band of the Year. U2 from Dublin, who'd been around for 20 years, who released an album called All That You Can't Leave Behind, which was not as good as their last five albums before the album that came out before it, which was their worst album. But because it was not pop, they won the Grammy, and they won Artist of the Year at Spin, which at the time was prestigious. Like, literally, it made the AP wire.
Sarah Lewitton. That's how desperate the music world was. I was insisting that Muse win that honor for Origin of Symmetry, an album not even available in the States, which fell on very deaf ears. I stand by my claim, though.
Mark Spitz. The Strokes were still a front-of-the-book band, but they were moving up quickly. I thought, we're Spin. I believed in us getting there first and beating Rolling Stone. We're at the Christmas party, and I said to Alan, God himself opened up the skies, parted the heavens, and handed us meaning Spin and us meaning New York after 9/11, this fucking band. This is the band of the year. What the fuck are you doing putting U2 on the cover as the band of the year? U2 is not the band of the year. This is not 1987, this is 2001. And I probably said a lot of other things that I don't remember, because the next morning I got a phone call from Tracy Pepper, and she said, "Mark, if you want to keep your job, call Alan and apologize. Immediately." And I did. And Alan, who had seen a lot crazier and a lot tougher than me, accepted my apology very graciously. I kept my job. And within, I would say, maybe 6 months, give or take, Alan was gone. He left Spin to start his own magazine. Saya was the editor-in-chief. I was assigned The Strokes' first cover story, and they were Band of the Year in 2002. By then it was apparent to everyone on the street and everyone in England and everyone who gave a shit about culture that the revolution was real this time, and the Prodigy wasn't it. It was Julian and Fab and Nick and even Nikolai and Albert. Especially Albert. Chapter 33. Cats started to get out of the bag. Mark Spitz. You know how they say Black Flag got in a van and they brought punk rock to the world? The Strokes got on a bus, and they brought downtown cool to the world. Along with the internet, they were changing everything, not just music. They were changing attitudes. The Strokes were making New York travel with them. I saw kids in Connecticut and Maine and Philadelphia and D.C. looking like they had just been drinking on Avenue A all night. 16-year-old kids in white belts and Converse Chuck Taylors with the greasy hair, hair that had been clean a week ago. Those kids had probably never even smelled the inside of a thrift store before Is This It came out. They found a band that they wanted to be like. They found their band.
April Long. The Strokes really did create the blueprint for the international hipster look of the aughts. The skinny jeans, leather jacket. You can add a mustache or a flannel shirt, but the baseline is essentially still the same, even now.
Mark Spitz. You know that scene in 24-Hour Party People where they see the Sex Pistols at the Free Trade Hall? And then the very next thing you see is them ripping their old posters down? Like, that's what it was like in the fall of 2001. Other bands' posters were instantly irrelevant. Jim Merlis. We held off doing any TV until Saturday Night Live. It was Jack Rovner's idea. Let's have the first appearance be Saturday Night Live. I remember he called me and Ryan up to his office to have this conversation, and he thought he was going to have to try to convince us, and we were like, no, that's awesome. They were so nervous and stoked, and it was really sweet. Nick Valenci, we were so excited to play Saturday Night Live. That was a really big thing for us. I don't remember getting that call, though. Every day at that point, there were new and exciting opportunities being presented. My brain kind of had to go numb because if we get emotional and excited about it every time, you're going to drive yourself crazy. Ben Blackwell. It was kind of hilarious when the Strokes were on Saturday Night Live. Albert was wearing a Yeah Yeah Yeahs pin. That was big news.
Karen O. At the time, if I'd run into one of the boy bands, they'd all ignore me. I swear to God, I couldn't get anyone to look me in the eye.
Albert Hammond Jr.
No way, I talked to her. I wore a Yeah Yeah Yeahs pin on my jacket the first time we played Saturday Night Live.
It's just gotta be hard with all those guys. It was even hard between just the guys. Jim Merlis. As a publicist, all these things, these opportunities, there was no map, no phenomenon like this before. Also, it was already the beginning of the backlash, because they were getting so popular.
Jesse Malin. People were jealous and angry.
Jaleel Bunton. When something blows up, you find out about it first in New York. The culture is always right in your face. You see a band that's become a wild success, and they are right next to you. It's not like I read this in a magazine, no, they're sitting at the bar, living the same life right next to you. Except their life is awesome and yours totally sucks. It's hard to be in that proximity.
Fabrizio Moretti.
I never felt comfortable, ever. I felt stressed out most of the time.
Nick Valenci.
It was all very exciting, but you almost had to just respond by doing something normal. I just did a lot of drugs.
Mark Spitz.
They would talk in code about drugs, but it was a pretty thinly veiled code. Like in True Romance, they called cocaine Dr. Zhivago. I'd actually never seen True Romance, and I didn't know what they were talking about. I thought they were talking about a fucking Julie Christie movie. Oh, are we going to go back to the tour bus and watch, you know, Omar Sharif?
Matt Romano. They got a lot of shitty press at the time because, you know, he's John Casablancas's kid, and they don't have any talent, and they're rich prep school kids getting all this press.
Paul Banks. People in other bands had this real need to say somebody else writes their songs, or they're just rich kids. You had to find some way to not accept the fact that there's actually five dudes out there that are cool as fuck that are writing insanely awesome music. And they did it by themselves. They are cooler and better than you are. And they will steal your girlfriend. That was just a really tough pill for a lot of people to swallow, including me.
Kimya Dawson. By that point, the Strokes are getting huge, so Adam and I are invited to New York City parties where you go in and people are, like, fancy. Models everywhere. I remember thinking, how is this happening? I would go in my bunny suit because I was scared shitless. It was just like, I'm not gonna fit in if I tried to dress nice.
Gideon Yeago.
The Strokes developed a cadre of comedians and SNL cast as fans, like David Cross, Horatio Sanz, and Jimmy Fallon. Those guys really gravitated to the Strokes. I mean, Jimmy is only a couple of years older than me. He wasn't omnipresent, but as they started to blow up, he was a guy that you would see backstage hanging out. Albert Hammond Jr. We're huge Mr. Show fans. Like 99% of our inside jokes are Ace Ventura or Mr. Show or Tommy Boy. Mr. Show was like our Bible of communication. Mark Ronson. David Cross had, certainly at that time, a little more indie appeal than Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy Fallon, girls loved him. College kids loved him. But it was easy to be a little snooty to Jimmy because he was on SNL and he was good looking. Ryan Gentles. Jimmy opened for the Strokes, actually. Mark Ronson. I was playing in Jimmy's band then, and I remember the first night on that tour, it was in Boca Raton, and it was this outdoor shopping mall. They must have been giving out these individually wrapped chocolates because we were just being pelted, and Jimmy was being heckled by this guy in the front. The passes for that tour said the Wicked Scepter Tour. Mark Spitz. Wicked Scepter are a gay metal band from a Mr. Show sketch. They don't realize they're gay even though they have anal and oral sex with each other. Albert Hammond Jr. Meeting David Cross was weird. We met him at 7B. He was in the bar, and we kind of went up to him. Julian Casablancas. I think we invited him to a show or something. David Cross. That was my local, 7B. I was there by myself, just hanging out, because I was friendly with all the bartenders. I was at the bar, and they were at a table. They were kids. They were looking at me, then looking away, looking away. I didn't think much of it. I think Juliet was the one who eventually came over, because she was the girl. They were big fans, etc. I must have heard of the Strokes, because when I moved here, the girl I was dating had an advance copy of their album, and I remember listening to it over and over again while painting my apartment in terrible New York City heat. Albert Hammond Jr. After we met him, it was kind of like, we got that out of our system. David Cross. They were really nice and just respectful, polite. Qualities you don't necessarily apply to musicians. A bunch of us went across the street and hopped the fence at the park to get high, the one on 7th and B. I remember Nick not being able to hop the fence very artfully. I thought, that's kind of adorable. What kid grows up in a city and doesn't learn how to scale a fence? It's a tiny fence. And yeah, they were Mr. Show fans, but it didn't ever get like, oh, I have to leave, this is getting uncomfortable. And believe me, with some people it does. They were totally cool. And then we became friendly. We were all in the same neighborhood, same circles. Stephen Trachtenbreit. There was something about the East Village, everyone seeing each other at the same bars. I remember those guys all played softball together in Central Park. David Cross and James Iha and Ryan Adams and Macaulay Culkin. Random. David Cross. Fucking Julian knocked in a couple of homers. I was like, Jesus, that guy. Who knew? The other thing about those guys is there was a lot of making out. Not in a sexual way, but in a making out way. Albert Hammond Jr. I always found it funny to kiss men. David Cross. I remember being in that bar upstairs at Irving Plaza, and Julian kissed me, and I'm going, whoa, what the fuck? But also having this crazy rush of emotions, because I know he's not gay, and I'm thinking, oh, that was fucked up, that was weird, but I guess it wasn't really unpleasant. That's nothing I'd ever do again, I don't think. Huh, that was interesting. It was my Bowie Mick Jagger moment. Albert Hammond Jr. I like how weird people get. I revel in their weirded outness. David Cross. He's a good kisser.
Fully shaved, soft, supple skin. I think he has access to really nice creams and lotions.
Catherine Pierce. Before Albert and I were together, we all went out to some show. Moby was there, and Andy Dick was there. Albert was there. I think Albert ended up at the strip club somehow. Andy and Albert were making out.
Albert Hammond Jr. Was that when I kissed Andy Dick? Catherine was like, what are you doing? And I was like, who gives a shit? It was probably before we'd gotten any coke, so I was just too drunk. I chased Catherine for a year. We first met when the Strokes were finishing Is This It? I went to Mercury Lounge. I was getting a beer when I saw her on stage, and I was like, she will be mine. I had left her a flower with my name and number, saying, if you ever come back to New York. 6 months later, she came to New York. It was the summer when we were doing Reading. I came back from Reading, and we started hanging out, but she didn't want to date me.
Catherine Pierce. Yeah, he pursued me. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, which is so culturally shut off. I was so naive. I went to New York when I was 16. It was the first time I met people with different ideas and people that believed different things, and it was so exciting to me, and I just thought, oh my God, this is life. Most people in Birmingham get married at 20, have kids really young, and I just realized I wanted to go explore life, and that seemed like the perfect place to do it. But it wasn't until Albert started dating James King. That's kind of when I was like, wait a minute.
Albert Hammond Jr. I met her at the Spider-Man movie premiere. I asked for her number that night when I saw her, and then I called her. But I wanted Catherine. David Cross. I had a couple of really awkward, embarrassing moments with those guys.
Catherine Pierce. I love David. I did ridiculous things with those guys. I smoked crystal meth with them. I didn't know it was crystal meth. I was such an idiot. David invited them all over, and he was like, I have this stuff called glass. And I was like, what's glass? That sounds pretty.
David Cross. Julian once crashed at my place, and he wanted a blanket, but I didn't have one. So I gave him a mattress cover. And I remember him, as he's sleeping, saying, I'm sweating. This comforter is really heavy. He probably lost 2 pounds that night. Right after that, maybe 6, 7 weeks later, my then-girlfriend and I were invited over to Julian's and his then-girlfriend Colleen's place. We had a very nice dinner, bottle of wine, and I go, oh man, I have this videotape my friend sent me. I'm friends with the guys in Nashville Pussy, and they will send me videotapes and DVDs of all this crazy weird shit that they collect. Stuff you'd now find on YouTube, but this is pre-YouTube. I had no idea what it was, just thought it would be funny. We put it on, and it's the nastiest German bestiality porn. I'm like, whoa, I didn't. And of course, the more you're going, I had no idea, the more it doesn't seem like a viable defense. It was really awkward.
Jenny Eliscu. New Year's 2001 was that show at the Apollo.
Gideon Yeager.
Yeah, cats started to get out of the bag at that point.
Catherine Pierce. That show with Guided by Voices and David opening was a total blur. I remember it being amazing and dancing, having the best time, singing every song, looking at all of them on stage. Thinking that they're like a boy band in the sense that they all have their personality and they're so dynamic. But they're fucking cool and they play instruments too.
Ryan Adams. That Apollo show, man, that was one of the best shows I've ever seen. They had lighting like I'd never seen before, where they were all in silhouette, and the background changed colors and the place was going nuts. I remember Ryan Gentles nearly passing out several times because Julian kept going off the front stage. Ryan was like, ah, he's going to fucking kill himself. I was like, he's pretty loose. If he falls, he's just going to bounce. They would finish a song, and Albert would put both of his arms in the air like, I did it. They were just pure. They were some of the purest people I'd ever met. David Cross. That was one of the top 5 worst experiences I've had. It was brutal, and I knew it was a bad idea.
and I tried to convince them not to do it, and they were very adamant about doing it anyway. People were rude. I just turned my back to the audience and talked into the microphone and said, "Look, guys, I'm contractually obligated to be up here for 45 minutes. It was New Year's Eve, and I wasn't billed. It just said special guest, so nobody knew that I was going to be doing this. Everyone is timing their night out. Oh, I'm going to go get fucked up. I'm going to come to the show. Then I'll go see the Strokes and Guided by Voices. No, sorry, first you have to sit through 45 minutes of a guy who thinks he's funny." A year later, I was at a show at Maxwell's in Hoboken, and I ended up getting into a fight with a guy who was at that show. He was still angry because I fucked up his high, so he pissed on me from behind. His name was Taliban Jim, and he got this nickname because during 9/11 he was out in the streets screaming that the revolution had started.
Gideon Yeago.
By the time they got to Coachella that spring, it was just Strokes mania. Ryan Gentles. Drew came to Coachella. Jim Merlis. I got a call from Drew Barrymore's publicist or manager saying, "Drew and Cameron Diaz want to go backstage at Coachella. Can you help me, through the Strokes, do that?" I was like, "Wait, you need my help to get them backstage?" Ryan Gentles. I was the first person to greet her. She wanted to come and see the band, so the manager goes, "I'm going to take her back to the trailer." And nobody was there except for Fab. I was like, "Oh, I don't know where they are." "Well, Fab, this is your friend Drew Barrymore." And it was like, "Oh, nice to meet you. I'll go get the rest of the guys. Hang out here, have a beer." And Fab was like, "Cool." She just came by herself. We left for like 20 minutes. Strokes played their set. And when Oasis took the stage, Fab was making out with Drew Barrymore on the side of the stage. Then they dated for 5 years. Jim Merlis. I didn't go out to Coachella. 2 days later in the office, I get sent this huge bouquet of flowers, and it's like, "From someone, thanks so much." And I couldn't figure out who it was from. And all of a sudden, I'm getting calls from the People magazines of the world asking, "What's up with Fab and Drew Barrymore?" And I'm like, "Oh my God, the flowers are from Drew." David Cross. Fab had his string of girlfriends, and there was one of them where I'm like, "Oh, that's not going to end up good. That can't possibly..." Because you just knew the other person involved, and you were like, "This is not meant to be. This kid is going to get his heart broken." Jim Merlis. Coachella would have been like, "Yeah, go wherever you want." They didn't need my help getting backstage. They needed my help meeting the band. David Cross. Do I think of Drew as a heartbreaker? Well, look at her history. And she's super sweet. I've met her a couple of times. And she is in that same vein of Fab. Just a genuine sweet person. But I think also very true to herself in the sense of, "I love this, I love this. No, I don't love it. Bye."
Catherine Pierce. Drew's been famous since she was 5 years old. Everyone in the world knows who she is, pretty much. There was a force around that was bigger than them, and it was really interesting to see that dynamic. Everyone wanted to know what she was going to say. Everyone wanted to know what she was interested in. It was a big deal. It became normal eventually. She's very down to earth in ways, but at first it was like a bigger thing that had come along.
Chapter 34. It's our time. Nick Zinner. Really, the way we write is essentially waiting for Karen to be inspired by something. Once she enters that world, then you can follow. It's just melody, shape, and will. Getting into that world where you're not hyper-judging everything and overthinking. Things just happen. They come from somewhere you don't understand. Art, with a capital A. It's inexplicable, and fantastic in its inexplicableness. Asif Ahmed. I've got to hand it to Nick. He's definitely talented, and he's definitely the true artist type. He doesn't put anything on. I think he's insecure, like any artist,
but he's fucking talented. He'd be a great, great producer. He does it instinctively. Karen does too, and Brian. They were kind of a perfect band.
Karen O. How do I know when I've got something? It's totally unintellectual. I feel almost like a little kid. I get, like, butterflies in my stomach, or I get a wave of euphoria, or I get the chills, or I cry. I have very visceral and physical reactions to it. If it's not right, I feel like I want to throw up or I want to pull out my hair. It's a different kind of intelligence, emotional intelligence. Your intellectual mind sucks, you know? I wish I could just put that part of my brain away for good.
Nick Zinner. The first time I ever felt that feeling of, yeah, we really have something that I want to share, was for our first EP. I was psyched.
Karen O. Totally, the first EP was when it happened.
Brian Chase. We had a rehearsal space on Avenue B where we recorded it. Nick Zinner. It was just a demo. Just something to help us get shows at the Mercury Lounge or Brownies, opening for other bands. But I felt that urgency and need to transmit it to the world. Asif Ahmed. I had the EP that Karen had given this bartender at Odessa. People kept giving it to me. At one point, I found myself with 9 copies of this fucking thing in my apartment. I finally played it one night while washing dishes. Our Time came on, and I was like, fuck, this is a great song. My friend Rachel suggested I manage them. I'm like, I don't know. Brian looks like Eddie Munster. The other guy looks like Eugene Levy. And they're all really pretentious.
Karen O. Asif was only a few years older than me. He was younger than Nick, so he just seemed like another kid, another playmate, looking to get caught up in our monkey business. I think we also heard he was capable of making really great deals.
Asif Ahmed. We met up at this horrible dump of an Irish bar, one in one. They were already talking to a bunch of other managers, but they were kind of freaked out by the established old people. Because I was around their age and everyone already knew me, it was easier. I spent probably a good 20-25 minutes making them laugh, trying to warm them up. Even to the point where I would, like, take a piece of brownie or something and black out a tooth and smile. Shit that you would do for kids. That's what they needed. Dave Siddick. Asif is the original reality TV star.
Karen O. We weren't ready for some serious, uptight manager who would do a really good job with us. We wanted someone who was fun and funny and kind of as much a mess as we were. We wanted someone to be able to relate to, and Asif, oh my god, he was a mess. Totally fucking irreverent, really ballsy, audacious. He was hilarious and dangerous, a loose cannon, and just in it for the fun, too. A lot of the psychology with the music is, what can we get away with? Let's see how far we can go. And that was Asif's vibe. He was like, let's see what we can get away with. He dug our EP and found his way into hanging out with us, and we thought, hey, this guy is cool. Let's have him be our manager.
Asif Ahmed. We had a kinship in that we were suburban middle class and had an appreciation for pop culture. Sarush Alvi. For the Vice 5-year anniversary, I decided we should throw a party. Yaya Yaz's master EP had shown up to our office just before that. The self-manufactured, not even in stores one. I remember the day it came in. Eddie was listening to it, and I was like, what is this? He was like, I don't know. This just came in the mail, but it's fucking great. The address on the back was Metropolitan Avenue. It was Nick's apartment, if I recall. We got in touch with them, interviewed them for the magazine, and I booked them to play this party. I can't remember the rest of the lineup, but they were the most memorable thing that whole night. David Cross. The first time I remember seeing the Yaya Yaz was at a weird fashion Vice thing at one of those dumb clubs. I think it was called Wet. Sarush Alvi. It was at Spa in Manhattan.
Justine D. It was called Spa Wednesdays. It was more fashion and art people, but we only played rock. We had a Vice party there, and this was before Vice really blew up. and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs played for $400. I know the budget because I managed Wednesday nights. 1,000 people were there. At that point, they had been playing Brownies, tiny venues.
Sarush Alvi. It was one of these perfect parties. We had a line around the block. We got McDonald's to cater the party. We illegally put the McDonald's logo on the flyer and basically took $750, gave it to interns, then went to the Union Square McDonald's and bought everything. We had costumes. Someone was the Big Mac, I was the Hamburglar. And we walked around with trays of food. The crowd was like a pack of wolves. When people are drunk like that, it's like, McDonald's, oh my God, it's so good. The vibe was just building, and the energy level was so high.
Karen O. I remember being beyond trashed. The hedonism and debauchery of that time was off the chain. Vice seemed to really embody that, so when you couple that with us, in that moment in time, it was a good combination, but also a horrible combination.
David Cross. There's like 10, 15 shows I remember where I was just blown away, like, holy fuck, these guys are amazing. One of them was one of Yeah Yeah Yeah's first shows. They just blew me away. They were so good and so impressive. And as cliche as this sounds, a breath of fresh air. This was so real and raw and heartfelt and organic, with a sprinkling of importance. And she was a girl. Still is, in fact.
Karen O. I remember there being an instant mosh pit. We don't usually have mosh pits, but there was one. I'm lucky that I don't have some horrible disease, because I just remember asking pretty much anyone in the crowd, "Give me your beer!" They'd hand me half of some super spitty pint of something, and I'd just be like, "Blah, down the hatch."
Sarush Alvi. Karen was partying and wasted, and they fucking killed it. Like, blew the roof off the fucking place. It was the show that launched their whole fucking thing. The bidding war and everything. The hype level went from, hey, there's a cool band in Brooklyn, to, oh my God, this band, Yeah Yeah Yeahs. It shot them into outer space.
Karen O. There was just such urgency and self-destruction. Just the need for release, hedonism, and vice, they were all about it. They kind of prided themselves on it, and so did we.
Joe Levy. I made a point of playing records I knew nothing about on Wednesdays. Their first EP was provocatively packaged around a theme of dominance and submission. It was a girl wearing a necklace that said Master in big gold letters. Mark Spitz. Yeah. They were an exciting band. That little EP got the shit played out of it at the Spin office. She was bold in her lyrics, and there was a lot of people on staff who, like, really got off on what she was bringing to the scene. As a fuck son, you suck. People were like, I'm about that. I like that. That needs to be said. She brought some good, put the rock boys in their place sort of energy.
Karen O. Do I think being a girl had anything to do with our outsider status as a band? I think it had everything to do with it. April Long. Karen O was the first immediately iconic female to emerge from a small music scene in a way that made a big impression in so long. She was like a Debbie Harry, but for our generation. And it was incredibly inspiring to see. I mean, everything she did was so freaking cool. Karen O. I remember going to see this James Chance show at the Cooler back in the day. There was some boy there. Just the dregs, the bottom of the barrel. But at that point in my life, I was into it. He was totally blowing me off, and I was getting wasted. But Debbie Harry was there. I go up to her and say, "Yeah, I'm in a band, and, sometimes I just feel like a girl in a boy's world, you know? I'm a total drunken 20-year-old stranger trying to harass her." She was just like, "Honey, just enjoy it while it lasts." It was really disappointing at the time. I was like, that is terrible advice. It felt condescending or patronizing. I was like, what the fuck? It felt cynical. But in hindsight, she's totally right, man. She's right as rain. None of that shit matters. I mean, it does matter because it's shaped us, and it's shaped our career, and it's shaped who I am as this artist. I am a girl in a boy's world, and like a lot of women in a lot of different fields, I felt really isolated. But it also doesn't fucking matter. Enjoy it while it lasts.
Rob Sheffield. That EP was really hard to find, and should have been hard to find because it sounded like crap. Nick once told me that it was on a cassette, and he put his jeans in the laundry so the tape went through the laundry, and that's what they mastered it from. I was like, you know what, dude? I believe you. It sounds like it was recorded in a dumpster. Joe Levy. With some sense of pride, I will tell you that Rolling Stone was the first national publication to cover them, possibly the first print publication to cover them. That record arrived in the office, I played it, I went to see them, and I put them in the magazine. Things don't usually happen that way. Asif Ahmed. They played a big show that December at Brownies, and every fucking manager was there, still trying to sign them. Every fucking label was there. I was at that show that Karen said from the stage, "Our manager Asif is standing in the back." She was wasted, of course. But that's how I found out. Officially, I was managing them. Then everyone turned to me, and it was like Walking Dead. I'm like, "Mommy!"
April Long. People were crawling all over each other to get to the stage. It was already mayhem. They had much more of a huge impact for me than some of the other bands, because I was like, they are raw, but so alive, and so, so sophisticated, and fucking amazing looking.
Joe Levy. I saw them 3 times at Brownies in that period, and they were 3 of the best shows I've ever seen. All of the things that people talk about when they talk about Yeah Yeah Yeahs were there. Karen O grabbing 3 beers in her fist, drinking one and pouring the other 2 over herself and over the mic stand. You know, all of this unhinged, deeply hilarious, completely spontaneous behavior. At the first show, it was all girls in the front. They were all her friends. They were giving her drinks. And there was this sense that there was something happening here, and it involved girls. All in on a secret that nobody else understood, which was completely exhilarating. Because 99.999% of the shows you go to, you're lucky if there's a single girl there. Let alone the sense that girls are not just participating, but in control.
Christian Joy. I feel like a lot of girls, myself included, finally felt like we had someone on stage we could relate to. Someone who did not give a fuck in the same way we did, and didn't mind being dirty and unsexy, and was just being herself and was not a dude. I think we felt like we owned the moment. We would go to the shows and go absolutely bonkers in the front row. Karen was our fearless leader. We would come out of the shows absolutely covered in bruises, dirty and drunk. We were totally arrogant fuckers, just like boys. It was the first time I felt like I had women like myself around.
Asif Ahmed. Karen was the only girl, but she knew that she didn't want to be exploited as a novelty.
Karen O. I get grilled a lot about, "Are you a feminist?" and "What do you have to say about it?" And I always come up short. I do feel like the work speaks for itself. I just wanted to really be in the work rather than the talk. I do always feel like I disappoint because I'm not on the soapbox.
Joe Levy. But let me stress again that yes, everyone had the sense that we were seeing something special, but not important. It was a fucking nobody rock band on Avenue A in New York City. There wasn't any chance it was going to turn out to be important. Jason Gordon. Yeah, I mean, it was really just a fun time in New York, and it didn't seem like it was going to ever explode nationally. You're like, these bands are awesome, but who was ever going to listen to a band with a song called Bang? She's talking about a guy's penis in that song. That's not going to be a mainstream band. They're not going to be on the radio. They're never going to sell out a big place like Bowery Ballroom. Nick Zinner. In the band I was playing in before, we tried so hard for 2 years. When I met Karen, I'd already given up any hopes of doing it for reals. so it was all 100% sincerity. Asif Ahmed. At first, the most controlling of the band was Nick. He didn't even want my name on the website. None of them did. They just wanted my email at the bottom of the page. No one wanted a manager because it was not cool. I'm like, you know what's also not cool? Poverty. But they didn't have that worry as much because they grew up, I wouldn't say privileged, but they grew up with parachutes. It shouldn't be held against them. They're incredibly down-to-earth people. But you could tell that they were really educated. And no one who is that educated is poor. John Spencer. We invited Yaya Yaz to play with the Blues Explosion on a West Coast trip, and it became a package thing with Yaya Yaz and the Liars. At the time, Karen was dating Angus.
Karen O. Liars were huge for us. They were a brother band. They were the best band as far as I was concerned. This is how we felt before Angus and I got together. Though it wasn't that long before I tried to, you know, bag that one.
Asif Ahmed. He's very... I'm trying to think. Jack Nicholson, an easy rider, but Australian. Very smart, very pensive. He was a big stoner. And monosyllabic. Yeah, mate. Sup. Yeah, but amazing on stage. They were in love, 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 love. Couldn't separate them.
Karen O. He was ever so dreamy and seemed totally unobtainable. And he also liked to play the whole I'm gay thing. He'd use that as a kind of cock-block thing, but just between him and chicks, and it would just magnetize him.
John Spencer. They would alternate. One night Yaya Yaz would play first, then the next the Liars would play first. They were together in a bus on this tour.
Karen O. I remember being in the audience at a Blues Explosion concert and just psychically trying to send the message, just look at me, just look at me, just look at me. If he even glanced over in my direction, I would be like, yes. So when I finally met those Blues Explosion guys, like when John and Christina were in the same place where I was, I felt legit. Like, I'm legit because they're here. They were really quite the New York couple of the 90s.
John Spencer. When they came along, that was at the time when I began to think these are no longer really my peers. Up until that time, I'd always toured with people I'd known, or people my same age. It began to sink in that these are people who are a good generation below. We also toured with them in Australia, which was interesting and a bit embarrassing, because at that time it was some of the last tours we did with a promoter that we worked with for several years. And they were being wined and dined and courted by labels and definitely by this promoter. We were just sort of along for the ride, even though they were our support act. Asif Ahmed. We did our publishing deal first. I remember negotiating that in Heathrow Airport over text. I was sitting in the smoking lounge screaming at the lawyers, screaming at the publishing woman. Because there was this $1.5 million deal looming over us. And in the meantime, I was just trying to get another 30 grand to cover lawyer fees. Later, I remember cutting them their checks with the business manager, and they just seemed so unaffected by the whole thing. We handed them the checks, and they were just like, cool, thanks. So anyway, here's a new song. Meanwhile, I'm like, fucking cocksucking little bitches. These were big checks. Like ridiculous checks. Nick Zinner. The first tour was March 2002. We went down to South by Southwest. That was our first big tour, opening for Girls Against Boys. Dave Siddick, later from TV on the Radio, was our roadie driver, and he rented this minivan.
Karen O. The minivan tour.
Dave Siddick. The brakes gave out on that van, and so I went to a Pep Boys and bought all new calipers and replaced the brakes on the side of the road. They asked, how do you know how to do that? Like, what the fuck? That's what they depended on me for. Asif Ahmed. Before they left for their first South by Southwest show, Dave Siddick was their tour manager, and I made them lunch. They left them on the curb outside the fucking apartment, those bitches. I remembered all their birthdays. I was like a little mom. Here's your lunch. And who has got a tingle before the road trip? Dave Siddick. I met Nick first. I think it was the second Yeah Yeah Yeahs show ever at Don Hills. There were probably 60 people there. Brian and Nick came out on stage and started playing for a while. And I was like, this is pretty wild. Then Karen came out in a gold lamé one piece covered in olive oil and sang as if there were a million people out there. We were just shocked.
Karen O. I thought it was our first Maxwell show. We really left an impression on him.
Nick Zinner. He's sort of like our spiritual mentor. He's the raddest dude. He's like 1,000 years ahead of everybody.
Karen O. I call him my hairy Polish-American muse. Dave was one of the handful of people I've crossed paths with in my life, where from the moment I met him, I felt like I had known him my entire life. In a pretty significant, like, we were probably related to the same mother in a past life kind of way. From the moment I met him, there was no doubt in my mind that he wasn't a stranger. I felt like that with Nick, too.
Dave Siddick. Yeah Yeah Yeahs asked me to go on tour with them because I was the only person they knew that had ever been on tour. We went around the U.S., down to Austin and back, and other places in between. I'm a nutcase, and I told them I was unqualified, but they didn't care.
Chapter 35 Troubled Souls.
Laura Young. The Strokes had the persona of being hard-edged, drunk rock and roll dudes, and Interpol were dark and mysterious. You know, troubled souls. Sarah Lewitton. In my mind, it was Blur versus Oasis, Interpol versus The Strokes. And I'm on Team Interpol, even though the rivalry didn't exist. I'm sure they're friends. April Long. I observed the rivalry thing with much amusement, because they were all of a larger whole. It wasn't, you know, Limp Bizkit versus The Strokes, it was Interpol. If you liked smart, stylish rock music, chances are you would probably like both of them. But yes, the perception of a rivalry existed, so that was amusing. Karen Ruttner. I was still in college at the time, and cool kids at Columbia were into The Strokes. I hated those kids, so I was kind of like, fuck The Strokes, I don't give a shit about that band, because those guys like them. I wasn't into people that were alternative for the sake of being alternative. When The Strokes first arrived, they struck me as a cultural identity band in a way that grossed me out. They were so cool, you know. Sarah Lewitton. Gideon Yeager would always go to 2A and hang out with The Strokes. I would always go to Lit and hang out with Interpol. The Strokes wrote pop songs. Interpol wrote... Well, that shit's not going to be on the radio. Justine D. Interpol used to come to Lit all the time, and The Strokes never went. Audrey Melody Nelson. The very first show I went to in 2001 was to see Doves at Bowery Ballroom. I got there early to see the openers I had read about in the NME. I don't specifically remember what I read, but I remembered the name and the buzz around them. The band was The Strokes. I didn't immediately fall in love. All the songs sounded the same to me, and they were much more raw than what I was into at the time, which was Doves, Elbow, Placebo, Star Sailor, South. The very next show I went to that year was to see Arab Strap at the Bowery Ballroom, and sure enough, Interpol was the opener. They had a huge impact on me. They became my New York band. Karen Ruttner. I just didn't care about The Strokes. I was an Interpol chick.
Daniel Kessler. It's hard to keep a band together when shit's not happening. Basically, you have to break up or you have to be like, no, we're really doing this. There's no reason to be doing it other than that you really want to. Later, you can have all this other crazy shit happen, but that foundation of no one caring stays in you. We kept going even though we were getting rejected by every single record label, even Matador. Brian Long. Stylistically, they were just so far away from what we considered cool. The 80s were not considered cool at that time. Andy Greenwald. So the summer of 98, I interned at Matador and at Spin. But Nils Bernstein, who everyone knows and is a wonderful human being, he's the one who had rescued me from a pointless intern.